The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to the program. This is Mike Consul. My guest is Greg Davies of Oxford Risk. And our topic is behavioral finance. Greg Davies is a specialist in applied behavioral finance, decision science, sustainable investing, and financial well-being. He founded the banking world's first behavioral finance team at Barclays in 2006, which he led for a decade. In 2017, he joined Oxford Risk to lead the development of behavioral software to help people make the best possible financial decisions. He holds a PhD in behavioral decision theory from Cambridge and is author of Behavioral Investment Management. He's a frequent speaker and lecturer and runs behavioral wine tasting events with Master of Wine John Downs. We'll have to get into that a little bit later in the program. Greg Davies, welcome.
Mike, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
I appreciate your time. Let's begin by having you define. I think people kind of intuitively know what behavioral finance is, but they're not in the field and you are. Define behavioral finance for us.
Sure. I don't think I'm going to add a great deal to the intuition there, but behavioral finance is really a combination of behavioral psychology and finance theory, and it's a study of how and why people make the financial decisions they do. And that's important when we contrast it with classical finance, because classical finance is all about understanding what people should do if they were being completely logical and rational. And we know that we're not. As humans, we're fallible. And behavioral finance is about understanding that fallibility. And in particular, in the work that we do, it's about how do we help people to overcome that? So behavioral finance in an applied sense is, how do we help people make better investment decisions?
You know, on the Oxford Risk website, it says flat out, investors are not rational and on average lose 300 basis points per year due to emotional decision making. And I've heard that most investors lose money during a bull market. They come into the market, the market drops, they freak, they sell at a loss, the market is restored, they buy high, and repeat the behavior with the next downturn, which is just disastrous. What is it about when you say investors are not rational? This sounds fairly genetically based. Some people kind of get things. They don't run on emotions. They run on fact and reason a lot of the time. I think all human beings run on emotion, but at least there's an overlay of fact and reason for many people. They can be persuaded. How much of this is just hardwired?
A great deal of it, a huge amount. And I get a little bit uncomfortable actually with saying it's not rational, because the hardwiring is there for a reason. We have evolved in order to survive in the world, and surviving in the world means making rapid responses to threats. And the problem that we have is not that those behaviors are irrational. They're just sometimes ill-fitted to the world we're in and what we're trying to achieve. At its heart, I think the problem is that what we are typically trying to achieve in our financial decision-making is to grow our wealth over the medium to long term. So we're trying to make decisions that have consequences many, many years in the future. However, every single decision we make in the present, we make now, we make today. And therefore, all this hardwiring is very much geared around protecting us in the short term, the fight or flight syndrome. If I've got to escape a saber-toothed tiger in the African savannah back in the Stone Age, there's nothing irrational about me having immediate emotional responses that leads to immediate action. The problem is that in a world where we're trying to achieve things over a period of years, that hardwired emotional response that we feel in every single decision can actually be detrimental to us.
Now, I'm going to ask you to cross the Atlantic for just a moment. We used to have a Fed chairman named Alan Greenspan. You might know that name. And he, at
Awesome.
one point, talked about irrational exuberance, just kind of the opposite. Rather than people freaking out at a loss, they got overenthusiastic about market gains. And he had used the term irrational exuberance. What about that part of it? Because I know part of behavioral finance, one of the components of it is herd mentality or herd behavior. And what did you at the time, and I'm not sure how much attention you were paying to what he said at the time, but what do you think about that, the idea of irrational exuberance and people getting overenthused about a particular, whether it's a market trend or a new asset class, say Bitcoin or cryptocurrency in general?
So I think these, whether it's fear, irrational fear perhaps, or irrational exuberance, are just two contrasting examples of the same underlying thing, which is, as humans, we like to feel comfortable with our decisions in the moment, and so we pursue decisions that give us that comfort, that make us feel comfortable. And depending on the context around us, the decision that makes us feel comfortable may be quite different. So when times are good, when markets are soaring, when we look into the newspapers and we see particular assets or asset classes that are going up, then the thing that makes me feel comfortable is joining the herd, is buying. The thing that makes me feel uncomfortable is sitting outside and watching all my friends achieve investment returns while I feel, like I should have joined in 6 months ago. And in one sense, it's really no different to the panic at the bottom of the market, where, there, my the thing that that the emotion that draws me towards a decision that is short term is the fear that it's going to get worse, et cetera. So in a way, these are two completely different things. Yes, overenthusiastic or overly fearful, but they're really just manifestations of the same thing, which is our tendency to want to make decisions that in the moment make us feel good.
And investment managers are not immune to this either. What you see oftentimes is here's this a very hot wagon that they're riding. They can see that this is not sustainable. This is not going to last. Now would be a great time to get out. But if I get out and my competitors don't get out, then my clients are saying, why am I seeing the gains still being made in this asset class, and I'm not participating in these gains, but I've got friends with other investment managers or pension funds with other investment managers that are making these gains. So there's a lot of pressure on investment managers not to pull the trigger too early. And what we so often see is it hits the wall, and then they look irresponsible for not having taken precautions.
It's interesting that individual investors, your only client is yourself. And actually, you have a great advantage over a lot of professional investors, and you have the advantage of time, because a professional investor or an asset manager or an institutional investor has exactly the problem you've just described. It's not, even if I'm right, I can be wrong, because if I'm right too early, and all my clients are responding emotionally, then I'll be right, but I'll have no assets left to manage. So it's interesting that in many ways, the very fact that as an individual, I don't have to judge my investment performance on the 1st of January or the 31st of December or on any particular date, I have a huge advantage over a professional investor who's going to be judged at certain time horizons and has to navigate this problem where I have to sometimes do things that I think are wrong in the long term in order to keep my clients happy with me in the short term.
Yes, exactly. So let's talk about this behavioral finance team that you headed up at Barclays. It's said to be the first of its kind. It was 2006 when it was created. You led that for a decade. How did it come about, for starters? Was this something you proposed, or did somebody reach out to you? How did it start, and what was the nature of its work?
So it wasn't something I had proposed to Barclays. I had finished my PhD in behavioral finance a year or two before. It was starting to become something that the industry was looking at, or industry in general was looking at, because there'd been a number of popular books on the topic. Daniel Kahneman, who's often thought of as the father of behavioral economics. He'd won the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2002, which was a neat trick since he wasn't an economist. He was actually a psychologist. And so it was starting to grow. I'd helped set up a consultancy that was taking ideas from academic decision science and behavioral science into the industry. And I had been trying to persuade a number of banks that they should be looking at this. And Barclays was not one of them. They independently, I think somebody had read half of a Malcolm Gladwell book and thought, oh, this sounds really interesting. Bear in mind, this was pre-financial crisis. So this was a time when a lot of banks had a lot more money than sense. And quite frankly, I think we were an experiment. Barclays was looking to grow its wealth management division. It had relatively deep pockets at the time, and it wanted to try new and innovative things, and we were one of those things. So it was a wonderful time to be in this because we were the first merely by dint of just being early. And then the financial crisis hit, and that, of course, set everyone into a tailspin. And it meant that we had a significant advantage of several years before any of our competitors started up comparable teams. But what the team did essentially was we were tasked with taking ideas from the academic world, from behavioral psychology, from behavioral economics, from behavioral finance, and bringing these into the organization with the idea of using behavioral finance to help our clients and their advisors to make better financial decisions. So in a way, what we were trying to build was decision support tools. Tools that go, classical finance tells us what the theoretical right answer is, but I know that these individuals in front of me are human. I know they're fallible. I know that right answer may often be uncomfortable. So in order to get people to good investment outcomes, I also have to think through their psychology and their behavior. And what we were doing was building tools that equipped advisors and equipped clients with some of the decision structure to help them to navigate not just what am I trying to do, but how do I get there in an emotionally comfortable way?
So what happened when the great financial crisis struck? Did Barclays, because of your unit there, did it have any advantages there? Did it deal better with it than a lot of other organizations, behaviorally speaking, and its clients' behavior was maybe a step above?
Yes, in some ways, although we hadn't been there long enough, I think, to get as deeply embedded as we would have liked at that point. So where it was used and where our advisors and private bankers had been using this with clients, we had substantial evidence that it helped people to sit tight, it helped people to stay calm. It was interesting, the financial crisis, because almost the only subfield of economics that came out of that looking better than when it went in was behavioral economics. Macroeconomics, microeconomics, all the others really went through a period of feeling quite discredited through and following the financial crisis. But one of the interesting things in times of crisis, and then whether it's that one or whether it's a COVID pandemic, is it really does focuses people's mind on the realities of human decision-making and the realities of our emotional responses to things. So I have always, from from sort of 2005 afterwards and since, I've always find that when we're going through times of crisis and worry, that's when people's interest in and willingness to think about behavioral aspects to economics and finance actually strengthens. And that's usually a good time for the behavioralists, because it becomes very immediately apparent to people that we're all emotional and that it has costs. Whereas if we're going through a time where markets have been going up steadily for several years and everything's rosy, then everyone thinks they're a great investor and they've got no evidence to the contrary, and they're not really that interested in the behavioral side of things.
So when the COVID-19 pandemic struck, I would imagine that that was a bit of a petri dish for you, because you got to see human behavior on a global scale with this very a fear-based situation where people were in fear for their health and even their lives, especially in the beginning when we didn't really know. I mean, we thought the worst in the beginning, and it turned out not to be as bad as originally conceived. But I'm curious, when you observe that, were there things you could extrapolate from human behavior in that situation that you could apply to behavioral finance?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a fascinating time. And I think when it first happened, of course, this was an unprecedented situation for all of us, and it took some time to assimilate. And there were clearly very strong behavioral factors at play, not in a financial context, but on how people were responding to restrictions, on how policymakers would think that people would behave and respond. So that was one strand of it running through. From a financial perspective, it was interesting. We saw some fascinating behaviors. The tendency of many people when faced with huge uncertainty to batten down the hatches and to pull away from risk and to sit tight. We saw a surge in interests around concepts of resilience, concepts of, you know, creating safety buffers, of concerns about the optimization, almost the fetish of optimization that the finance industry has through normal times, where you try to get the maximum amount of effort or the maximum amount of product out of the minimum number of inputs. And this creates organizations that are that lack resilience, because everyone is trying to always, you know, be as streamlined as possible. So we saw a lot of people going, oh, you know what, there's actually a benefit to us having a pile on the side that buys me the safety, the emotional safety and the financial safety. And that became very, very evident to people. We saw a lot of people pull back from spending, a lot of people pull back from risk. But at the same time, we had populations of people who had now had often more cash on hand, because they could no longer go out and spend it. They couldn't go out, they couldn't go on holiday, etc. People who had a lot more time on their hands, and at the same time as we saw some parts of the population pull back from risk and pull into cash, we saw the exhibits of the Robin Hood and the GameStop and the you know, the meme stock examples happening. So you had these two completely different behaviors happening at the same time, both as a response to the same set of conditions. And of course, some of the you know, whether you were in one camp or the other, often was a question of demographics, you know, what are your wealth levels, what is your age, etc. But it is interesting there, and this to me has been a thread that has underpinned, you know, almost everything we've done for the last 15 years, is we can talk about behavioral finance. Classical finance tells me there's one right answer. In behavioral finance, the fact that people are individuals matters a lot. The same or two different individuals can have wildly different responses to exactly the same set of circumstances, because we have different emotional responses to things. We appreciate context differently. We come from different backgrounds. We have different financial personalities. And these things mean that the same decision can play out in very different ways for two people, even if from a financial position, they have absolutely identical financial circumstances. And that becomes really, really important when you're trying to help people make better decisions. Understanding the individual becomes absolutely paramount.
You know, I'm going to ask you in just a minute about best practices for financial advisors and managers. But first, you know, you mentioned Robin Hood and meme stocks and such. So what about the idea of being in the public market, the very liquid public market, the ease of being able to extricate yourself from equities, let's say, versus illiquid, private market, illiquid or semi-illiquid assets, where you're kind of frozen in place and you might want to respond, but cannot respond. Now, the average retail investor probably doesn't have much in the way of illiquid assets in their portfolio, but you've obviously observed the distinction there. And I ask this question in part because you see a lot of investment houses now moving more towards the private markets and illiquid assets or the kind of interval type funds to diversify and stabilize portfolios, but it also has the effect of maybe stabilizing the investor himself or herself. What about that whole thing?
Yeah, absolutely. We should say that a lot of retail or individual investors often do have an illiquid asset, which is their house. And it is always fascinating that people will absolutely agonize over the fact that their portfolio has dropped 2% in the last week. And yet, if their house price had diminished by 5 or 10%, they wouldn't even know because it's not being marked to market. So the emotional state of a given asset value going through a given change can be entirely different just depending on the information that you have on it. And so you're absolutely right that private assets or assets that are not frequently marked to market or assets that you cannot extricate yourself from, even if you wanted to, they have built-in behavioral stabilizers. And that can be extremely beneficial. Of course, you know, they have other problems because, you know, sometimes there are good reasons to want to get out of something. And if you can't, that can be a problem. The one thing I would say, because this is one of the lessons that we learned quite early following the financial crisis, is we tried a little bit to almost deliberately play that card. One of the dimensions of financial personality that is most important is composure. It's a measure of your tendency towards emotional engagement with the journey, with the here and now. And people who are low composure individuals are ones that are more predisposed to buy high, to sell low, to overtrade, to make a lot of the behavioral mistakes that you see in the markets. And so we thought exactly along the lines that you're going right now, which is, if I have a low composure investor, what I should really do is put them into illiquid funds or absolute returns funds that they can't get out of very quickly. And it will mean that when the panic comes, they almost have a built-in cooling off period before they're able to move. And most of the time that works really, really well. The problem comes when you have a huge crisis like the 2008-2009 financial crisis, and the drop is absolutely enormous and it goes on for a very long period of time. At that point, this can have unintended consequences, because then what you find is the same people who benefit from that, the low composure people, are also the ones who get most stressed when they're locked into something that they cannot get out of. And what we found is that some of those people, when they could get out, now it might have been a few months later than they would have got out of a completely liquid thing, but they were so badly emotionally burned from that they got out at any cost and they really struggled to re-enter the market for many years. So you're absolutely right. These things can be beneficial, but they can also have unintended emotional costs and unintended consequences thereafter.
Okay, so best practices for financial advisors and managers, if you were, and you've just indicated one of them, okay, you have a low composure client, try to secure them with maybe some illiquid assets in that portfolio. Although, as you say, that can have unintended consequences. So if you're talking to a room full of financial advisors and managers about what to do with clients who are reactive to big market moves, what are the best practices you would impart to them?
Okay, well, firstly, prepare. When people are in an emotional state, when markets are in turmoil, it is very difficult then to suddenly step in and calm them down. So every client, even if they have a tendency to be low composure, can be turned into a better decision maker if over the several years leading up to that, firstly, you have identified that they are that person. And one of the things, you know, we specialize in at Oxford Risk is building psychometric tools that can identify and score people on multiple dimensions of financial personality. So we can identify exactly what is your score on composure, what is your score on impulsivity, what is your score on confidence, etc. So knowing how your clients are different from each other is absolutely important. And then using that knowledge over time to help prepare them. It's always been interesting to me that it's never an if about whether your portfolio is going to drop in value at some point. It's an absolute certainty that your portfolio is going to drop in value at some point. And if we don't know when, but if we know that something will happen with certainty, we should be able to prepare for it in advance. So it's a matter of taking those, you know, potentially nervous clients and starting to build up the narrative of this will happen to you at some point. How is it that we should behave when that happens? And one of the tools that I think can be most useful is helping people to write an investment constitution. So helping them over time to think about and actually write down a set of rules that they can use to govern their own decision-making. If my portfolio drops, what are the things that I should allow myself to do? What are the things I should not allow myself to do? How often should I allow myself to look at my portfolio? What are my rebalancing principles? And if we spend several years, you don't have to do this all at once. It can be something that you develop gradually over time. But if I know who someone is, if I know what their financial personality is, and over a period of years, I can help them to write a set of rules that they can start to internalize, that they can start to almost, in some cases, automate. Then what you've done is you've helped people to take decisions away from their future emotionally charged self and give the decisions to that person ahead of time when they're cool, calm, and collected, so that when the time of emotional crisis comes, we're not making all these decisions from scratch. We go, I've got this because I know that I knew this was going to happen, and I've got my little rule book that I've written up that helps me to navigate this. And I use the word constitution deliberately because it's in exactly the same way that a country will use a constitution to make sure that in times of peril, in times of crisis, that we cannot as a country make decisions that are actually against our values and our principles. And as individuals, we can do the same thing at a much smaller scale.
Well, my constitution would include, you know, sitting back with a glass of wine, sipping on that, and maybe tuning into one of your behavioral wine tasting events with Master of Wine John Downs. Tell us about that. What's behavioral wine tasting?
Yeah, so I've worked with John for many years. There's only 400 or so masters of wine in the world, and he's one of them. So he knows his wine extremely well. And many years ago, this was when I was at Barclays, we used to do wine tasting events for our clients. And John was, you know, one of our chosen wine experts that we used. And I remember sitting in on one of these talks, and he was talking through the sets of rules that he uses when he's tasting wine or he's sitting one of these exams. Because when you're drinking 12, 20 different wines in a row and you're trying to identify what they are, we get very quickly bamboozled. Our palate gets confused. There's an enormous amount going on. It's like we're in the heat of a turbulent market. It's very difficult to know which way is up. And John was busy describing we've just come off the investment constitution. He was busy describing his wine constitution. He said, the way I helped myself to navigate and be a more accurate wine taster was I sat down and I wrote for myself a set of rules that took the wine apart and said, you know, I've got to think separately about the nose, about the color, about the taste, etc. And I wrote a set of rules that tried to remove the subjective me from this. I'll give you one of his rules, which is wonderful. So it's very, very important to know whether a wine is acidic or not. But you taste a wine and you think, well, I don't know, is that medium? Is it medium high? Is it medium low? Almost impossible to tell, particularly after you've already drunk a number of wines. So he said, there's one thing I can rely on. I cannot rely on my brain to get this right. But it turns out the more acidic a wine is, the more we salivate. So he has this thing called the dribble test, where he will take a sip of wine, swirl it around his mouth and tilt his head forward and count to see how quickly, how long he lasts before his salivary ducts start producing saliva. Now, what it does is it takes something out of the subjective world where we have to emotionally make a decision about something and puts it into an objective framework. And he was describing really exactly the same sort of thing that I'm always trying to get investors to do. Try and fix for yourself a set of rules that can take your cool, calm, collected, and intelligent, logical self and make sure that that's the self that you're using when you're making decisions, even in times of stress and turmoil. So what we do in these wine tastings is we give people blind tastings. They have three whites, three reds, and I use live polling software. So the audience, unlike most things where you tell people to put their phones away, we ask them to take them out. And the audience is responding to questions live about the wines that they're tasting. And they can see up on screen what their answers are. And we use this to illustrate very effectively that people are biased, that we're subjective, that our decisions and our perceptions are all over the place. And then John will give his set of rules for how to de-bias yourself in the context of wine tasting. And I give a set of rules of how to de-bias yourself in the context of investing. So we're using these two very, very different things, wine and investing. Both are essentially about how we can deploy our human psychology more effectively in order to be more accurate, in order to be more effective. And it's a fun event. It's educational and you get to drink wine. So what's not to like?
Yeah, and underscores the power of extrapolation. Again, we've used that term a few times. My guest has been Greg Davies of Oxford Risk. He is a specialist in applied behavioral finance. And as you can hear, he's spent a lot of time thinking about how we behave in stressful times with our financial resources. Greg, thanks a million for taking the time and walking us through this.
Mike, an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.